The ongoing budget impasse in the Sacramento City Unified School District has it in jeopardy of receivership. There is a one-day strike scheduled for May 22nd. Yesterday, the state superintendent called everyone back into negotiations at a point to be named. On Insight Today, Sacramento County Superintendent Dave Gordon will join me in the studio. We'll continue the conversation I started last week with Karen Moore from the State Education Office. Then Cap Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Kayola addresses questions about measles. This disease, as you might know, is highly infectious, and even with winter winding down, the cases continue to show up in California and across the country. Later, Jim Martinez previews the second annual Roseville Jazz Festival, a two-day event this year. We have a bit of music to get your toes tapping. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. California's State Superintendent of Schools, Tony Thurmond, is calling all parties to the table to work through the impasse in the Sacramento City Unified District. The district is in what he characterized as severe fiscal deficit. A one-day strike right now is scheduled for May 22nd, which he said in a press release yesterday he hopes can be avoided, and that state receivership he hopes can be avoided as well. Thurmond says all entities have agreed to be in the same room. One of those entities, as he says, is the Sacramento County Superintendent Dave Gordon, and he's joined me in the studio to talk about Sac City Unified, but more broadly to talk about state receivership, which is a discussion I started last week with Karen Moore from the State Department of Education. Superintendent Gordon, thanks so much for coming in today.
Happy to be with you, Beth.
What about this call from the state superintendent for all parties to negotiate?
He called me last week talking about this meeting. And what I said to him was that my role in this process as the fiscal oversight body for the Sacramento Unified District is I'm there with the district to assist them in trying to balance their budget. My role is not to negotiate. Negotiations are governed by very strict rules, and they're to involve the parties only, meaning the district and the exclusive representatives of the labor unions, the bargaining units. So that process is supposed to be confidential between those two parties. Now, Superintendent Thurmond is well-meaning in trying to put people together and set some parameters for their working together. But in the end, the union has to come to the bargaining table and work with the district in order to hammer out a solution. And any disputes about bargaining requirements and contract requirements has to go through what they call the process of the negotiating system, which the state sets up through the Public Employee Relations Board. So there are processes to adjudicate disputes about contracts and bargaining, which need to go through that process between the two parties.
Does that mean that you are not necessarily informed when negotiations are happening? And do you know of any right now that are scheduled?
The teacher association, unlike the other bargaining units that the district works with, the other four or five bargaining units, has not been willing to come to the bargaining table thus far, despite repeated requests from the school district. So unless and until that bargaining can take place, it's going to be impossible to reconcile any of these disputes. But again, I commend the state superintendent. He's well-meaning. He wants to see these disputes resolved. But I think really the first step is to get the union and the district back together in the bargaining relationship that is governed by state law and all of the procedures around that.
Would you say more about your role? Because as county superintendent, it's not only Sac City Unified that you're watching over. However, those circumstances are the most dire in the county right now.
Correct. We have in the county 13 school districts ranging in size from 63,000 students in our largest district to 240 students in one of our small districts. I'm responsible for overseeing the budgets of all of those school districts. And we have a process by which we check in a couple of times a year, and then I review and approve their budget each year. But in addition to reviewing the current year's budget, I'm required by state law to look out at their projected budgets for the subsequent 2 years to make sure there are no warning signs on the horizon of fiscal distress in the offing.
The state schools chief in that same press release yesterday says the third quarter interim budget is due Thursday. And so that budget is coming from you, from your office, correct?
No. The way it works is the district does a regular budget, which has to be submitted by June 30th. After that, there's a check-in, which we call a first interim and a second interim budget, which they submit. That's another check on how they're doing during the course of the year. If there are problems, such as there were in Sac City, there's a requirement for a third interim budget. So that's what's being submitted by the district to me. And it's going to be approved. It's scheduled to be approved by the board this Thursday.
What are you expecting to see? How big is the gap now in the district that started at $35 million, but I hear has grown?
Well, it's grown and it's gotten smaller for different reasons. It grew because the arbitrator issued a ruling which added dollars to the bargaining agreement that the district struck about a year and a half ago. Then, on the positive side, there were significant cuts made by the board. The board, I give them a lot of credit. They've been working diligently to make what reductions they could over the past 5 or 6 months. So they've made some reductions. So in the third interim, we will see the result of all of those changes. And then I have an opportunity to review the third interim submission and respond to the district as to where we think they are prior to their submitting the final budget for next year for fiscal 19-20, which is due. They are due to approve that final budget at their June 20th meeting.
Superintendent Gordon, in reviewing what's been happening in Sac City Unified in its budget issues, is there one most clear or most compelling factor that has caused such a, as was characterized by the state school's chief, severe budget deficit?
Well, I've been reviewing these budgets in my 14 years as the county superintendent, and I think the thing that has characterized what's happened in Sac City is what we call deficit spending, meaning taking one-time monies and perhaps assuming they will continue when oftentimes they do not. Other problems that they've had would be overreaching on expenditures where they were not in a position to back up those expenditures long-term. One-time money really should be spent on one-time items. So that's been a persistent problem, and I have pointed that out in letters to them over the years.
That sounds to me like it falls under the jurisdiction of the superintendent and the school board of the district.
Well, again, the way a district works is it really should be a partnership between the employees and the management. And in many of our districts, it's a very positive partnership here in the county. In Sac City, there have been these periodic disputes which erupt where there isn't always the level of collaboration that would be needed or most helpful in resolving these issues. So hopefully that will come to change and the parties will be willing to sit down and work together, because together is the way I think you can reach solutions and move the district forward in the healthiest fashion.
I'm talking with Sacramento County Superintendent of Schools David Gordon. He has joined me because what's looming out there for Sac City Unified and other districts in the state, admittedly, is this need to get an emergency loan from the state. Sac City Unified isn't at that point yet, but it's called receivership. Can you characterize what point a district has gotten to when it has to look at what receivership means?
The standard for a district going into receivership, or we call it insolvency, is literally when they run out of cash. So there are cash flow projections that are made throughout the year and into future years. So the point at which they run out of cash is when the state is obligated to give them a loan, because unlike a city or another jurisdiction, a school district can't go bankrupt because the state under the Constitution is obligated to provide public education. So in the case of an insolvency, the state would make a loan to the school district. The school board would be set aside. Their powers would be suspended. The superintendent would be dismissed, and I would be empowered to appoint what's called an administrator to run the district, and my choice of the administrator would need to be affirmed by the state superintendent and the president of the State Board of Education.
The part that you just described, which is your responsibility to choose the administrator and then oversee that, that's new since last year under state law, correct?
That's correct. It used to be the state superintendent's responsibility to select and oversee the administrator.
How does it make more sense, or how does it align better to have you handle that decision making?
I wasn't a party to the discussions, but my assumption is that the feeling was that someone closer to the locality would be in a better position to judge who would be a good administrator in a case of insolvency.
And just to be clear, a lot of what we're talking about would be the same in almost any county across the state, given the same setup of a county office of education and the local districts with their school boards. There are some counties where the offices are the same because they're smaller, and that's the exception to the rule. But otherwise, we're not talking about something that's necessarily unique to you, David Gordon, or the Sac City Unified School District.
No, my authority is the same for all other counties in terms of the budget oversight and the insolvency, if that comes to pass.
Are you then the person that gave Sac City Unified the negative certification, and what does that mean?
That's correct. The negative certification comes when you are unlikely to remain solvent in the subsequent fiscal year. So when there is a risk of insolvency in the subsequent fiscal year, the county superintendent would put you in a negative certification, and then I have the option to place what's called a fiscal advisor in the school district to assist the school district in trying to resolve the budget shortfall.
If the sides, the parties, can't all come together and there can't be a plan by June 20th is the deadline for a budget, and the cash runs out when? Sometime after that? Might that be weeks, months?
Well, the cash flow is a very tricky thing to project and predict. So when the budget comes in, based on what cuts have been made, the cash flow usually moves around. And so the date of when the district would run out of cash would move around. I can't predict what that would be until we see the final figures that the district is submitting in terms of what they've been able to cut so far.
School districts don't borrow money from banks, correct?
School districts sometimes borrow money from banks. Typically, they'll borrow money from the county treasury. But the idea is when a school district gets to this point, its credit rating is damaged, and it generally will cost them more money to borrow. But with a state loan, the state is the one that borrows the money and gives it to the district, and the district has to pay back the loan with interest. So that's one of the reasons that you don't want to go insolvent, because on top of everything else you have to cut to stay even, you have to provide money to pay the state loan back. So, for example, Oakland is still paying $6 million a year off the top of their budget for the loan that they got many years ago.
You have a long career in public education in this area, and I know that you've seen schools in various levels of financial wellness and difficulty. What's the ripple effect when a school district struggles or moves into receivership, the ripple effect to the students, to the classroom?
Looking at the districts that have gone insolvent in the last 10 or 15 years, typically what happens is they will lose students, they will lose enrollment, their enrollment will decline. Typically, they will be in a position where, because of having to repay the loan, they will have to cut programs that are supportive of students, particularly our neediest students. But worst of all, I think, is the reputational damage, not only to the school district, but to the community. And I think that's one of the things that's most crucial in this community. Sacramento is on the upswing. Sacramento is moving forward. There's good leadership in Sacramento, and the district should be moving in that upward direction, not in the direction that it's moving. And that's my hope for where all of this will end up, that Sacramento Unified can turn this around and really have a plan and have great collaboration among all of its labor partners and the school district and really move the school district forward, because Sacramento Unified has some of the neediest young people in our community, in our region. And they deserve the best possible chance to rise up, to step up and go to college and get great jobs. And I'm hoping that's where we can end up.
I'm talking with Sacramento County Superintendent Dave Gordon. What about the timeline? Today is May 14th. That strike is planned, the one-day strike, for May 22nd. A budget for the 1920 school year is due June 20th. Cash has to be an issue, as you said, a moving target out there. And then to consider receivership, you also need to consider the legislature being in place and being able to vote on a bill to approve the loan. What's possible given the short number of weeks or months?
Anything is possible if people are of goodwill and they're willing to sit down and work out their differences. And that's what I would urge the parties to do. Come to the table. As I said, the district has been urging the teacher association to come to the table. All of the other labor partners are participating at the table. Let's everybody sit down and work this out for the good of the students and the good of the community. Would be I would implore people to do that right now. We're running out of time, and time is the only thing we can't get back. When we run out of time, we're out of time. So let's get working together. In my experience, strong collaboration among a district and the labor partners generally produces strong programs and a culture and a climate that is positive and will move the system forward into the future.
One more point I want to ask you about. Recently, a court-appointed arbitrator ruled in favor of the teachers' union in the Sac City Unified District, and this had to do with a salary increase that was discussed for mid-career teachers. Is there a solution here to uphold and observe that arbitrator's ruling in favor of the teachers and still reach the kind of cuts that the district needs to reach?
Yes. Yes, the arbitration ruling wasn't a court-appointed arbitrator. It's appointed through the process of collective bargaining. The district will abide by the arbitrator's ruling, and that will be worked into the budget projections.
Okay, so the entities that need to come together also will include the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistant Team, includes FICMAT?
Well, FICMAT is who the state superintendent is inviting to the meeting. that they don't have a role in either the local budget oversight process or the collective bargaining process.
Okay. It's complicated, isn't it?
It is complicated.
I think the only thing that we can do...
It's complicated, and it's not, because the collective bargaining process is complicated. But what's not complicated about it is supposed to take place between the two parties, the employer, which is the school district, and what's called the exclusive representative of the employees. Those are the unions. That's who's supposed to be together working on the collective bargaining process. And it's supposed to be confidential between those parties.
Part of the goal in having these conversations is to do more than just say a strike is scheduled, to do more than just give a headline. I appreciate that you and Karen Moore last week have joined us in the studio. It's unusual to be able to have these kinds of conversations, frankly, in the midst of what would be a negotiation time. But because you're here, before I let you go, is there anything else that is important to say about the brink of shift that we're on, whether it goes one way or the other?
Again, I would just reiterate, in the interest of our kids and the community, please, everyone, come together, come to the table through the appropriate process to work this out. There's a solution here if people work together in good faith and collaboratively, and let's move this district forward. It can be a great, great district. It has many, many bright spots in it, and very, very hardworking people, administrators, teachers across the board, and a very strong Board of Education and superintendent. So I encourage everybody, sit down, roll up your sleeves. There's still time. Don't run out of time.
Superintendent Gordon, thank you again for joining us on Insight.
And thank you for featuring this issue. It's so important to our community.
That is Sacramento County Superintendent Dave Gordon. You can follow continuing news about Sacramento City Unified School District, and we'll post a link to the conversation I referenced last week with Karen Moore at capradio.org. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight, live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. If you live in California and you have children, you are being asked by the state to follow age guidelines and vaccinate your children against measles. This would be the MMR vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. Not all parents believe in vaccinating children, but it is a highly contagious disease. Measles is. It can have serious complications, and it spreads quickly where vaccination rates are low. In our ongoing Great Question series, Cap Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Cayola has collected the questions that have been coming in from listeners, some from our own staff, in fact, and she's here now with those questions and some answers. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with countries where measles are and some of the countries where measles are being imported from.
Right. So we've seen four outbreaks in California. They're linked to international travelers. And we've had 45 cases in the state. 30 of them are tied to these outbreaks. The rest are standalone cases. But we're seeing adults traveling to other countries and bringing the disease back. The countries that the California Department of Public Health has noted where these people have been are the Philippines, Thailand, India, Ukraine, Vietnam, and Cambodia.
The CDC says across the country right now there have been more than 800 cases in what's considered these recent outbreaks. And there is a little bit of a weather factor here, the seasonal change that should be making a difference at some point.
Yeah, typically this is a winter disease. So you see the cases start to level out when the weather gets warmer. But, you know, we are still seeing new cases each week because people are bringing them back from countries where the disease is more common. And then when they get back to the U.S. if the people around them aren't vaccinated, it's still spreading.
Of the 45 cases in California, are any of them in patients who have been vaccinated against measles?
So actually, yes. So the numbers show that of all of these adults that brought measles back, three quarters were either fully vaccinated. Sorry, I take that back. Three quarters were not vaccinated or were under vaccinated. So, yes, most people were either unvaccinated or under vaccinated. But there were some people that had all their shots. And Dr. Gil Chavez, deputy director for the state's Center for Infectious Diseases, has more on that.
And then we had a few who had the two full doses of measles. Now, you have to remember that measles is a very, very effective vaccine, one of the most effective vaccines we have. Two doses provide 97% protection. But that means that even in the best of cases, 3% of people who are immunized are not fully protected. And when you multiply 3% by 30 million people in California, that's a lot of people that potentially could be susceptible to measles, even if they were vaccinated.
Let's clarify. This is a two-dose vaccine. So if you're under vaccinated, what they're saying is you've only had one of the two doses.
Right. And what he's saying is, there, you know, even if you get both doses, there's still this kind of small chance that you could catch measles and bring it back. But for the most part, the people that brought the disease back from overseas had no doses or just the one dose, the underdose, like you said.
So if you are planning international travel right now, health officials are advising.
Yeah, make sure your shots are up to date. And if you're not sure, call your doctor.
How long does the measles vaccine stay effective? Is this one of those that adults need booster shots for?
Tricky question. It depends on the year you were born. So some adults do, some adults don't. If you're born after 1989, you probably got both doses and you don't need to be revaccinated. If you were born between 1957 and 1988, you may have gotten that single dose version, which is less effective. But still, officials are not recommending that you revaccinate unless you're traveling internationally or you work in healthcare. Then there's this kind of special group between 1963 and 1967 that probably got an alternate version of the vaccine that wasn't effective. So those people should get revaccinated. And if you were born before 1957, you most likely caught measles as a child and you have natural immunity. So you should not get revaccinated unless you're traveling internationally or you work in healthcare. So it's a complicated puzzle. Just tell your doctor what year you were born and consult them.
I think that aspect of natural immunity is interesting. We think about that for chickenpox, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you had it, if you remember having it as a kid or your mom or dad remember you having it, you're probably okay.
All right. If the cases are being brought in from unvaccinated adults traveling to countries where measles is common, then why is so much of the conversation around school-age children not getting their shots?
So the risk of getting measles from abroad and bringing it back is always going to be a risk, and not too much has changed in that situation. But when somebody brings it back and everyone around them is vaccinated, it just is usually a standalone case, and that person is sick and they get better. But when they bring it back to a community where many, many people are not vaccinated, especially children who are so good at spreading disease, you know, they touch everything, they touch each
right.
other. So if a case comes back to a community like that, it's going to spread quickly. And that's why we're seeing these big outbreaks. And it's, you know, it's that situation is changing because the vaccination rates in some communities are dipping. Dr. Karen Smith is the director of the California Department of Public Health. So she says there's really two goals here, right? One is try to make sure people are vaccinated before they go abroad. And the other is make sure people here are vaccinated.
One of the reasons that most of the travelers who've returned to California with measles have not spread it to others is because we have high vaccination rates in the state of California overall. A major part of that is ensuring that children entering school are vaccinated. Since SB 277, the law that restricted exemptions to medical exemptions passed, we saw an almost 5% increase in vaccinations across the state of California. That demonstrates just how valuable school requirements for vaccination are to ensuring that we have good community resistance to measles as it's imported into California.
So she's talking about the law in 2016 that banned personal belief exemptions. So basically, the only way you can get an exemption now is if it's a medical exemption. You have to have a doctor sign off on a form. And, you know, once the personal belief exemptions were banned, we actually saw vaccination rates rise across the state. You know, more kids were getting vaccinated. But we did see also the medical exemptions bump up. And there is some concern that people might be falsifying those medical exemptions. And so that's this year's bill, SB 276. It's a bill from Democratic Senator Richard Pan. And it would give the state health department the final say on whether a medical exemption is valid or not.
This can be such a difficult and delicate conversation to have around the subject of vaccinations. And I am talking with CAP Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Kayola. We are talking about questions that both you, listeners, and our members of our own staff have posed about measles. In fact, we've had some very lively meetings in our newsroom with all of us firing questions at you. What are some of the medical reasons that vaccinations are postponed and in some cases children aren't vaccinated at all? Now, this is medical reasons.
Yeah, there are a few legitimate medical reasons that kids should not get their shots or maybe need to wait a little longer. People with severe life-threatening allergies might be told not to get certain shots. If someone has a weakened immune system, diseases such as cancer or HIV/AIDS, someone who's in radiation or chemotherapy, they probably can't get vaccinated. And there are quite a few restrictions. You can find them on the CDC website. And patients should just tell their vaccine provider. Tell them if you've had tuberculosis, if you've recently had a blood transfusion, or if you have a close family member with a history of immune system problems. But really, talk to the person who's giving you the vaccine, and they'll be able to tell you whether you fall into that exemption category. And, you know, just what we're seeing in the schools is schools where, you know, half the children have medical exemptions. But these conditions are pretty rare. So the state is concerned because they're saying, well, not half the kids in the school have cancer or HIV/AIDS, right? So something might be going on with these medical forms.
Then there are the age guidelines. Is it true that children under 1 year of age can't be vaccinated for measles?
So there are times when you can vaccinate an infant who is 6 months to 12 months old. And they're recommending that for infants who are traveling abroad and for some infants who are at high risk if they're living in communities with low vaccination rates.
Okay.
But we're talking about 6 months to 12 months. The reason that they're not recommending it for the 0 to 6 month period is because at that stage in life, you actually have some natural immunity from your mom. And I talked to a vaccine expert, Dr. Paul Offit with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia about that.
The MMR vaccine can be given down to 6 months of age in an outbreak situation. So, for example, for children who are currently in Brooklyn or Detroit or Baltimore, and the, you know, the physician or the parent is worried that they've been exposed or that they might be exposed to measles. The reason you don't need to get it before that is that mothers typically of the young babies have been vaccinated. So they will passively transfer those protective antibodies to the baby through the placenta prior to birth, and that'll protect the child in the first few months of life.
That they might be exposed. He's saying if you're really worried about your child and they're 6 months and older, that you can bring them in and ask your physician for an early vaccination. But it's really supposed to be given after the first year.
Yeah, in a typical setting, that first dose is given to children between 12 and 15 months of age, that first MMR.
The first dose, right. And then the second dose usually comes when they're 4 to 6 years old.
Okay. So let's get to something called vaccine injury. And we've had a number of listeners ask about this. I think people are becoming more aware that there can be something called vaccine injury. But what is it and how often does it happen?
So I get this concern a lot when I'm out reporting, especially with a lot of parents who are opposed to vaccines or hesitant. You know, serious side effects are very, very rare. They can happen, but they don't happen often. So serious side effects would include, So like an allergic reaction would be a serious side effect. Long-term seizures and brain damage, but these are listed by the CDC as very rare conditions. Moderate events would be sort of joint stiffness or some unusual bleeding or bruising after a vaccine. And then there are minor incidents, you know, like a fever after or a rash or a swollen gland. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of doctors about this, and they say, you know, the chance that your child will get a fever after this, it's a small price to pay for protection from something like measles, which can be a very serious and fatal disease. And so, you know, I don't want to overblow these injuries because they are so rare. Just to give you a little perspective, the CDC keeps a database where people can file if they believe that they've been harmed by a vaccine or their child's been harmed. And that database sees about 30,000 reports each year, and 90% of them are mild side effects, the kinds of things I described before, joint stiffness, bleeding or bruising. So very few of those reports are a serious condition. And just because it's in the database, it's not a causation, right? These are just people reporting, okay, I got a shot and now I have this, right? But it's not proven that it was caused. So there has been a lot of misinformation about this. And the science just largely says that vaccines are safe and that serious side effects are rare. Vaccines do not cause autism. That's been widely debunked by major medical groups and scientific research. So, you know, I would direct people to the Centers for Disease Control website for more information.
Has a court ever compensated a petitioner claiming that a vaccine caused autism?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's this federal vaccine injury compensation program. Some people call it vaccine court. And it's where you can kind of take your case and say, hey, I thought I was injured. You need to compensate me. And between 2006 and 2016, there were more than 3 billion doses of vaccines distributed, and only about 3,000 petitions were compensated. Well, closer to 4,000. It's in between. Basically, for every 1 million doses of vaccine that were distributed, one individual was compensated. So in most of these cases, they don't find a causation.
But that was a number related to autism specifically?
No. No one has ever been compensated for a vaccine causing autism. So these petitions I'm talking about that went to the vaccine court, the one in a million that were compensated were for various other injuries.
Okay, I want to go back over that again because I think this is really important.
So there's a vaccine court. People can petition if they believe they've been harmed. But no one has ever been compensated for claiming that a vaccine caused autism.
Okay. But they have been compensated for other issues, but you don't know specifically what issues the compensation was for?
No. So there were about 3,737 petitions that were compensated over a 10-year period for any variety of injury that people may have filed for. But keep in mind, that's a very small number of compensations when you look at the 3.1 billion doses of vaccines given during that decade. So essentially, one in every million doses ended with a compensation.
One thing that might be important to point out is that some of the data we're talking about is available on the CDC's website or by doing some investigation. It's not that it's hidden or secret or Freedom of Information Act information. It is accessible.
Absolutely. If you look up the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, you can look up all of the petitions, who filed them, whether they were compensated or not. And you can also find the database where you can report if you believe something happened after a vaccine.
I do want to ask about quarantine with relation to measles and when and if quarantine is necessary.
So it can be. Generally, when someone comes back from abroad and they've gone to the doctor and the doctor tells the local health department, yes, this is a confirmed case of measles, they'll ask that person to stay inside for 3 weeks. That's how long the disease takes to run its course, just so that person doesn't spread it any further. Then there are situations where if they think a lot of people have been exposed, say it's a school with a low vaccination rate, and there's been at least one confirmed case of measles, they might ask everyone at that school to quarantine themselves. It's just an effort to prevent further spread, and it can be disruptive. And, you know, some people think it's extreme, but local health officials consult with the state health department to make the decision about when that's appropriate. Because, you know, when this disease spreads, if it gets to people who are already compromised or to babies, it can be really dangerous and really fatal.
Sammy, when you and I have a conversation like this, it could be easily either misheard or misunderstood, or someone might say, wait, what did she just say? I want to hear it again. So I do want everybody to know that all of this and more is on our website in a written form.
Yes, I wrote an entire digital article about this. Every question, every answer, there are links to the databases I've been talking about, links to the lists of medical questions. There are links to stories about the new bills being proposed. So I do encourage you to go online and to read up, because it's a complicated issue. But I think at the end of the day, it's the health officials in California and nationwide are being very clear. The safest thing you can do is vaccinate your child and vaccinate yourself if you're going abroad. Even if you're not going abroad, still vaccinate your child because it will protect others in the community.
All right, Sammy, our great question was many great questions this week. Thank you so much for joining us. That is Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Cayola. And again, you can find her digital article, a lot of information, including the map of the measles cases in California, at capradio.org. This is Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. For thousands of fans, young and old, December 18th, 2017 was one of those days that the music died, because that is when the Sacramento Music Festival, or Jazz Jubilee, as so many people know it, was canceled after 43 years of all of that celebration of Dixieland and traditional jazz. That's when Jim Martinez stepped up. He, as many of you know, is a talented jazz pianist. He has mastered the Vince Guaraldi playbook. He played in the jazz festival himself for 15 years. And in the gap that followed that cancellation, Jim started a new jazz event. It's based in downtown Roseville. The event has worked because in about 10 days, it's the second annual, and Jim Martinez, executive and artistic director of the Roseville Jazz Festival, is in the house. Welcome.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Beth.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Number two hasn't happened yet, but are you exhausted already?
Oh, I was exhausted 6 months ago, but that's what we work for, and I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Tell me about the response when you said, yes, I want to do this, and then it actually happened last year.
Wow. I mean, everything's a blur. I think that when the festival, when Sacramento decided they weren't going to do that anymore, all the musicians on Facebook and everyone I knew were talking about trying to do something to fill the void. And I thought, man, I'm the one who's been running around the country doing promoting shows and marketing, and that I got to step up and do this.
So you pulled it off last year. How many people attended, and how much is this year's event changing?
We had about 1,500 people last year with 4 months planning. I think the Manhattan Transfer brought a lot of people out.
Yeah.
And a lot of the local bands, we had some great following for the local groups too. And this year we're expecting to double everything. We're going from 1 to 2 days, Saturday, Sunday, and then the bands are just multiplying like crazy.
Five venues?
Five venues. Actually, technically four and one free venue outside for all the youth bands and some of the dancing in the evening.
Yeah. Talk about the span of groups coming this year.
Well, we have from the headliners. Oh, I'm excited about Mike Vax and the Stan Kenton Orchestra. We've got the four freshmen who, of course, everyone knows that they over the age of 50, you know, they grew up with them. And Tamir Hendelman's a good friend of mine. He plays for Barbara Streisand and for Jeff Hamilton and some great musicians and vocalist from Rebecca Hardiman from Portland, Oregon, and just some great. Paul Keller's coming back to Sacramento. He was a big headliner in the All-Star group for many years at the Sacramento Festival.
We're going to hear some of the music as you're dropping great names in just a moment. But what's your bigger vision of what you're trying to do? It's hard to rebuild something that was in the way, in the time, the era that it was. Mm-hmm. So looking forward, what's the picture to you?
Well, I think that Sacramento had they were based on the traditional jazz and Dixieland. And although they had all sorts of different genres, they had rock and pop, but they had, you know, straight ahead jazz like I play. They included a lot of different kinds of music. But what I'm I model myself after like Monterey or Newport Jazz Festival, where it's more Duke Ellington, Count Basie, you know, Nat King Cole, that kind of jazz. It's more, I would call it mainstream jazz. So that's kind of my vision. But I'm also including some traditional jazz and some Latin and some, you know, big band and some different flavors too, gypsy jazz and so forth.
Let's listen to a little of the Stan Kenton Legacy Orchestra with the Four Freshmen. This is a song called Day In, Day Out.
For it's a long, long time from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September.
And the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. One hasn't got time for the waiting game.
Everybody's settled in right now. That's the Stan Kenton Legacy Orchestra. So when can we hear them?
They're going to be performing four times over the weekend, and five if you include the open rehearsal with the Four Freshmen. And I believe they're closing each evening like around 7 o'clock Saturday and Sunday night, and then once in the morning on Sunday.
We'll post a link to the Roseville Jazz Fest, and you can find all the details of the performances, also ticket information as well. Mm-hmm. Tamir Handelman, let's hear a little tune right now called Passerim, and we'll talk more about it afterwards.
Nice, isn't it?
Yeah. Tell me more about that piece.
Well, I know more about Tamir. Tamir is a good friend of mine, and I met him many years ago at the Lionel Hampton Jazz Festival. And he plays for someone people have heard of, Barbra Streisand, which is amazing. And also when she does her jazz stuff, which she did, you know, at 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then Jeff Hamilton, the Clayton Hamilton Orchestra, and a very renowned pianist in his own right. And he's just one of my favorite pianists of all time.
So he performs on Sunday.
He's Sunday, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I do have one little surprise for you. Is this okay?
Yeah, I love surprises. Of course.
Let's listen to this great pianist and see if you can identify him.
Okay.
Sounds like Vince Guaraldi to me.
It does.
Who is that, Jim?
That would be off my last CD, I believe, Cast Your Fate to the Wind. That was my tribute to him.
It is. That's the one and only Jim Martinez. So when are you playing at the Jazz Fest?
Oh, I'm playing a bunch. I've got myself scheduled in about 3 or 4 times playing with other groups. And I have one set in the evening on Saturday that I've decided it was a Vince Guaraldi tribute, but I'm turning it into a Doris Day tribute.
Oh,
she passed away yesterday.
Perfect.
And actually was a friend of mine and had many phone conversations with her played for her 90th birthday party and got a chance to meet her.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Tell me about being her friend. What did that mean?
Well, I mean, she picked up the phone and called me, I think, about 8 times I counted. And I'd be getting yogurt and my phone would ring. It would say, Doris Day. And after I hung up, I'd look for people to tell. And if there were young kids, hey, Doris Day, just talk to me. They go, who's Doris Day? You know, because they were young kids. But yeah, it was an honor to spend some time with her on the phone and to meet her in person at her 90th party.
How did you first connect with her?
Well, you know, I started working with a vocalist, Laura Didier. We did a tribute to Doris around town, and then we started doing it nationally. And then I contacted Doris's manager, and we went down to Carmel at her hotel and started performing for her birthday parties. And so that's how we got to know her.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anything that you experienced with her on that personal level that is different or you can share from the way she's being celebrated so publicly?
Well, I'll tell you what, on the phone, she sounds just like she does in the movies, and she was very sincere, never bragged. I had to pull stuff out of her. And we ended up talking about baseball, about just stuff that, you know, just talk to a buddy about, and it was great. And in fact, I posted something on my Facebook page this morning, that a little snippet of a phone call. I asked permission to record one of the conversations, and just to hear her and her voice, it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was a great person and loved the animals.
When's the last time that she sang in front of you? When did you hear her?
Oh, I never heard her sing in person. She retired many years ago in the 70s. But the story is her assistant late at night put on one of my albums and she sang along with my CD. So inadvertently, I guess I kind of performed with her.
Oh, that's so lovely. So yeah. When can people hear you play her music, that tribute music?
We're going to do it Saturday evening. I think it's at 5:45, I believe. It's a Jim Martinez trio. And right now it says, I think, Good Grief, it's Jim Martinez, which is the name of my CD. But I'm going to change that today. It'll say A Tribute to Doris Day. And we're working with finding a singer, and we're going to do a great, we're going to have a lot of fun.
What venue? Where will that be?
It'll be at the Roosevelt Theater inside. And there's one ticket gets you into everything at this festival.
Okay.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Does it go without saying there will be a year 3?
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're really, and just to let people know that we're still looking for volunteers, so everything's on our website and they can click on the link and get a free ticket to come in. They volunteer a couple hours.
Okay, the Roseville Jazz Festival's second year is coming up May 25th and 26th. Thanks again. That's Jim Martinez, the festival's executive and artistic director.
Glad I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. We have to leave you with more music. Keep you in a really good spirit. Don't we all need that? We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.